This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. Well, this past week, I hope that you enjoyed the daily updates that I posted from Las Vegas there at the Orleans Hotel from Magic Live. It was a pretty good convention. In my opinion, there were some highlights and some that were kind of some lowlights. Nothing really kind of in between that was average. It was, I thought, really good or not really good. On a scale of 1 to 10, I'd probably give it about a 6, just a little bit above average. There were some hits and misses, but not enough misses to make it below average. Everything didn't hit on every cylinder this year, but it was certainly one I'm going to continue to go back to. It's going to be a lot of fun, and next year's convention is going to be August 7th through 10, I believe it is. So anyhow, that way you can set your calendars. It's just going to be moved back a day, but it's going to be during the same week, basically, next year. And I intend to be there, and it's always good to see what kind of new surprises Stan Allen is going to be having for us. While I was at the Magic Live this year, there were a few people who had come up to me and had said how much they enjoyed the podcast, and I made some new friends by just shaking their hands, and some faces I was able to put with some names or some emails from people I had received, and it was really great to see a lot of listeners. So thank you guys very much for coming up and saying hello, and a few people put some money in my hand then also, who are now supporters of the Magic Word. More importantly, they are friends of the Magic Word with that financial support. And a few of the guys that I want to mention who are the newest members of the Friends of the Magic Word, one is Richard Ingram, another one is Andy Pearson, and Sean Doonan. Thank you guys very much for your financial support and for becoming a friend of the Magic Word. Welcome to our intimate little group. We are still under 100 with over 15,000 subscribers. We've got like 100 of you who have donated anything financially. I know, I understand, whatever you can is fine, and if not, that's fine too. I'm just glad that you guys are enjoying the podcast, and again, I thank you for coming back and listening every week. Well, listen, we got a lot of stuff really to go through here this week, and my guest is Don Weiberg, and I had recorded this conversation with him when I was on my way up to the IBM convention in Grand Rapids earlier this summer, and while there at his home, we started talking about several things. I knew that he had worked at Riley's Magic Shop in Chicago, and also because of his interest in magic, because he's the past international president of the International Brotherhood of Magicians, and because of his knowledge of the history and the people he knew personally in the Chicago magic scene, I thought there's no one better to talk with about the history of magic in Chicago except for Don Weiberg. In this first of two parts, he will talk to begin with about some of the magic shops that were in the downtown area. It's kind of interesting that within just, I think, a four-block area or less, there were, I don't know, half dozen or more magic shops at one time. It's just kind of amazing. So we talk a little bit about that, but then we start also to tip a little bit of what we're going to be talking about next week, and that is the Chicago Roundtable. The Chicago Magic Roundtable, or the Chicago Roundtable, is something that's been around for a while, and there is an historic picture that has been painted that you might be familiar with that is by Salvador Sala, and I believe it has about 108 people whose pictures are depicted on this big picture, and one of the original numbered prints is actually hanging in the Chicago Magic Lounge. Anyhow, that the beginning of this podcast that we're going to be hearing now, really I was trying to focus more on the magic shops in and around Chicago, but there was so much to talk about for all of those people in the Chicago Magic Roundtable from early days that I couldn't fit it all into the next week's podcast. So towards the back of this, that we're going to get probably about a half hour or so of preview, not just a preview, but rather some information that will be about some of the early members of the roundtable. Anyhow, if you enjoy history, this is something that I think you will sit and enjoy. And I certainly did. In fact, we spoke for about 2.5 hours. And again, I broke this up into about an hour and 15 minutes, both this week and another one for next week. And so next week will be more on the Chicago roundtable. This week, it's about magic shops and the Chicago roundtable. So please welcome my guest this week, Mr. Don Weiberg, here on The Magic Word. Today I have with me a guest here in Chicago, Illinois, who actually is one of the major historians of Chicago as far as magic in and around Chicago. That's because he actually has lived a lot of the magic that has happened in and around Chicago, including having performed on the Bozo Show as well here locally. And he has done magic and as well as some clowning and has a great background in magic. And in fact, he is a past international president of the International Brotherhood of Magicians. And he has also worked with Mark Wilson, having traveled and done a lot of trade shows on behalf of Mark. And he had put him and his wife Joyce traveling around the country, including the Corn Palace up in South Dakota, I think that is. And he has performed a lot of different places and in a lot of different venues. And is now retired from actually being the secretary of the IBM after over a couple of decades. And so now he is dedicating his time to kind of, in a way, kind of chronicling history a little bit. And from time to time likes to give some talks about history. And I thought that would be really great to have an opportunity to sit down with a good friend of mine. Please welcome my good friend, Mr. Don Weiberg.
Well, thanks, Scott, for that wonderful introduction. And yeah, I've been very, very fortunate to have been around magic since I was 10 years old. And fortunately, growing up in the city of Chicago exposed me to some of the real greats in magic. And recently, with the opening of the new Chicago Magic Lounge and the rekindling of a magic spirit, and especially through an organization called the Chicago Magicians Roundtable, it kind of prompted me to really do some research and kind of dig back into my own memories and document something. It's, you know, wonderful to have an oral history, but you know, when I'm gone, that voice is going to be gone also.
They'll have to listen to things like this, the archive podcast.
That's well, right. I certainly hope so.
But not only that, of course, you have the knowledge of the history of the magic shops that used to be in Chicago. Now, Chicago was really the hotbed of magic, I would say. Of course, Chicago being the second city, meaning it was after New York City came Chicago, and you had worked then with the Chicago Architectural Foundation, and you and your wife, Joyce, for many years have been doing architectural tours around Chicago, and so well-versed about that. But part of that you do know about the magic shops, and I think it was kind of interesting, you had said before that there were, what, four, five, six magic shops in downtown Houston within a block?
Downtown Chicago. Yeah. You're in Houston. You said Chicago.
I said Houston.
Houston.
Okay, yes.
Blah, 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 blah. Yes, that's true. Well, Chicago, even though it was a second city, and there are several theories on why it was called the second city, one of which was the first city burned down in 1871. Oh. And when the city was rebuilt, it became the second city. Now, the other connotation was that Chicago was the second city behind New York because it was at one time the second city in the country in terms of population. Well, that record has since been surpassed by
Los Angeles.
The aforementioned Houston, I believe.
Yes.
Anyhow. So as a result of Chicago being such a large city and really became the crossroads of America, it still is the railroad center of America, not only, well, transportation not so much, but the freight trains that came into Chicago, and now with the air travel, O'Hare Field is really one of the major transportation centers. But by virtue of this, because it became such a busy city, it also kind of unofficially became the magic capital of the country. Mm-hmm. Now, New York, of course, was larger, and there may have been more magicians there. But in Chicago, there was a group of magicians at one time that kind of because of their common interests would just get together for lunch. And out of this grew the Chicago Magic Roundtable. And that started way back in 1929. Mm-hmm. And it kind of grew and grew and grew. But getting back to the magic shops, it's true. When I was a kid, you could remember streetcars, trolleys? Well, the Loop of Chicago, which is the Central Business Core, got its name because of the loop of cable cars that ran in downtown Chicago.
Okay.
And people often associate San Francisco with cable cars, which is true. They still have their cable cars, but Chicago at one time had one of the largest cable car systems in the country. And they made a loop in Chicago as they turned around and went back on the respective cable that they came in on. And that loop name has become synonymous with the downtown part of Chicago. The loop having been surpassed, or the cable cars having been replaced by elevated trains, still created a loop of raised elevated trains. And the name Loop has kind of become associated with all of downtown Chicago.
So is that what the L means?
The elevated train.
L is short for elevated.
Correct. And that started in 1893 at the time of the World's Columbian Exposition. Mm-hmm. But getting back to the magic shops, I take the streetcar downtown and get off at the Palmer House, which was on State Street, one of the oldest continually operating hotels in the country, and named after Potter Palmer, who was an early mover and shaker, entrepreneur. But the Palmer House at one time held the National Magic Company, which was, you walked in the National Magic and you knew you were in a magic store. Beautiful red and black lacquered cases, a little stage upon which to have the demonstrators present some of the wares.
Right.
And that was managed by Victorsburg, and owned by Jim Sherman, whose name is connected with magic. But and then from there, you could walk down the street a couple of blocks to, Joe Berg at one time had a magic shop on just off of State Street and Washington Street. And then we turn around the corner and you go up to Ireland's Magic Store on Dearborn, turn the corner again and go up to the Magic Center on Randolph or Elkito.
Wow.
Held forth. And then backtrack a little bit. You could go to Abbott's on the corner of Dearborn and Randolph. Walk a block west to the Greyhound bus terminal. George Kuhn, a name that's lost in the history of magic, had a magic counter. And there was also a counter in the Sherman Hotel, where you could buy at very high-priced tricks. Mm-hmm. Charlie Sanoff kind of appealed to the business traveler, and the much like
kind of like Magic Masters.
Yeah, like Magic Masters, yeah. Ken Fletcher's operation many, many years later. And then we also had Ed Miller's shop, which was more of a small-scale shop. And I only visited there once with a friend of mine, who was an officer friendly in Chicago, and he was having some props made for his, he had a local TV show, a little 15-minute program, and I can remember going to Ed Miller's old dusty shop, which was a throwback, but Ed Miller was also one of the premier poster collectors in the city, if not the country.
Magic posters,
yeah. Big time, and mm-hmm. then eventually those were acquired by Jay Marshall, and when mm-hmm. Jay passed away, a gentleman out in Las Vegas managed to scarf up the bunch.
Mr. C.
Yeah, Mr. C, David Copperfield. And then there was one other shop that I just happened to think about, and that was, again, very unusual. The Marshall Field department store on State Street was the premier department store. And in the toy department, Joe Zehring had a magic shop, or a magic counter.
Zehring,
okay. Z-E-R-I-N-G. And Joe was kind of a quiet, unassuming gentleman, but I'm sure in his own way he influenced a lot of young people that came down to buy toys to buy their first magic tricks.
So, well, now Riley's Magic Shop also, but that was in the outskirts?
That was
kind
out of the south side of Chicago, later. And that's the one that I have a certain fondness for because I worked there from the time I was 15 or so and on through high school, on through college, and then even after I started teaching, I still worked there Monday and Thursday nights and Saturdays, and then when that kind of stopped, he would still call. Joyce and I both worked there. And during the Halloween rush and the Christmas season, we managed to pick up a few hours of part-time work. And Riley moved around several times. And then one of his last destinations was out in a suburb of Worth, Illinois, adjacent to where we live. And our daughter even began working there mm-hmm. behind the counter at Riley's. So, but unfortunately, Riley's Trick Shop fell prey to the demise of brick and mortar.
Like all many other
shops, yeah. His business was primarily costumes and gag gifts. The magic mm-hmm. counter was always, when I first went in there, it was the magic counter. Oh my God, I have a picture that I suspect goes back to the 1940s, and there was a couple of kids looking down at the magic case in wonder, and I have reason to believe that it's me. just from the posture,
the way
I
wore
glasses
over.
At the time, and got my hands in my pocket. I'm intently, burning in on one of the tricks in the counter. And so anyway, that's – and there were other shops, too, that in the surrounding area, but there was one at Evanston, Top Hat Magic. But
and, of course, Magic Inc. was
– Magic – well, that was
later.
Long before Magic Inc. That came later because that was the Ireland Magic Company. At 107 North Dearborn. These are all numbers that are popping into my head. And Riley's, I can go through, doesn't matter, but I still remember the old phone numbers, 2-3-7-4-1-1.
Don't try that now.
No.
Well, as far as the magic shops go, since they were so close, how could they compete? Did they have different tricks that they specialized in? Did they make their own things? I know Riley's, I think, made some of their own stuff.
Yeah, Riley had the thing that got me started with Riley's was a trick called the Indian Mystery Stick. It goes by different names now, the Hoo-Ha Stick.
Hoo-ha,
it's a little notched stick with a propeller. And I came into Riley's after school one day, and he had a pile of these on the counter that he was putting together, putting a screw through the propeller into the stick, and there had to be a red Scotch tape label put on them, identifying them as the Indian Mystery Stick. And I said, gee, Mr. Riley, I can take some of those home and put them together when I watch TV at night. He said, well, why don't you come in? I'll give you a penny apiece, piecework, to put them together. So the following day, I came in and busted my knuckles putting these screws into the propeller and into the stick. And this was brutal. I mean, I bleeding knuckles. And so the following day, I went back to school and went to one of my mentors, Mr. Gleason, the woodshop teacher, and described what I was doing. And he said, why don't you figure out a jig to hold a bunch of sticks at one time? And we did. We took a board and cut grooves in it, or dados, and managed to get maybe 24 sticks at a time clamped in place. And
right.
Didn't tell Mr. Riley what I was up to when I smuggled the jig into the shop the next day, set it up in the back room, and bingo, I laid all these sticks out. And within a few minutes, I had 24 sticks knocked out.
There's a quarter almost,
scooped
right?
Scooped up, brought them to the front counter, and he didn't pay much attention. And this went on for maybe half hour or so, and the pile of sticks had grown immensely. And Jim said, what are you up to? What are you up to? I said, well, I'm doing the sticks, Mr. Riley. He said, yeah, but what? How many? There's so many. You can't do it as fast. And I just kind of shrugged. I was kind of a shy kid. And so then the jig was up, no pun intended. He came to the back room and saw my device. He said, I think we're going to renegotiate this deal. He said, no more penny apiece. I'm just going to pay you a flat $2 an hour. Well, that worked out, but the productivity dropped way down.
Well, now all these other shops that were downtown, a little at a time, obviously they were going out of business for a variety of reasons. But I know, for an example, that Joe Berg had some of his own proprietary things he sold, because I remember seeing those ads in the Linking Ring so many years ago. But I assume that others had something special that maybe...
Ireland's...
I mean, they didn't have wholesalers or jobbers like Murphy's Illusionist and all that now.
But Ireland's had a lot of their unusual items.
And they printed their own stuff, too.
Oh, and they published books. And that was strictly Francis. Laurie Ireland had passed away. I had never met him. Mm-hmm. And this was before Jay came
into the picture.
And
he was from Chicago, by the way, originally, or where did he come from?
Jay was from New England, the Boston area, I believe.
Okay.
And but at one time, Tom Palmer worked for Francis. Neil Foster worked for Francis, and it was a tiny little shop. We were there. Joyce and I had just started dating, and we were downtown one day, and this was in an old building with the old elevator, the gate that had to be closed by an elevator operator. And the shop was up on the fourth floor, if I remember. And we went in and did, I bought a trick or whatever. And we left the shop. And as we got into the elevator, which was crowded, Joyce had her back to the door as the gate closed. And the elevator operator rolled this big, like a steering wheel almost.
Yeah.
As the elevator started going down, her dress started going up. Wait, stop! And, oh, my God, he was terrified. Well, as the dress went up, it just... So he stopped the elevator. We went back up to Fran, and, you're back so soon.
Yeah.
Joyce, you got a needle and thread? She said, you got a little problem. Well, she turned around.
Big problem.
Big problem. So Fran stitched up the dress, and we were good to go and very cautious on the old elevator.
But then... Now, the Round Table was started about that time, Chicago Round Table, back when those shops were going then?
1929 is the official date of the Round Table. And to my knowledge, I don't know that there is any written history of the Round Table. There's bits and pieces of articles that appeared in the Linking Ring and perhaps other publications, MUM maybe, and the Sphinx. And if you Google Chicago Magic Round Table, you'll find a few hits, one of which is a tribute site put together by a young woman who I never knew, but I knew her parents. And there's a grievous error in that description, because it said the Round Table started at the Drake Hotel. Now, the Drake Hotel is a very upscale hotel on North Michigan Avenue. And although I can't verify this, I just can't imagine them allowing a bunch of magicians to sit in a restaurant spending
just
time
out,
and not money.
Right, just a cup of coffee.
So
the whole day.
I called attention to John Sterk, who is the very much involved in the Chicago Magic Lounge, because they had that same description on their site. And everything that I knew about was the round table was on Dearborn, 131 North Dearborn, which was the same block that the Ireland Magic Company was located, the same block that the Joe Berg shop and other shops had filled that space.
Right, okay.
And then the Chicago Magic Center, which is in the pro shop, is where Okito held fort. So there, the round table had been at a couple of other locations, which may have been just short-lived. And what happened to downtown Chicago, like anything else, there was a period of time when people were flocking to the suburbs. The suburban malls were attracting more people than they were downtown. And downtowns in Chicago, or downtown in Chicago and other cities just kind of dried up. After the office workers left at 5 or 5:30, they became ghost towns, and there was nobody on the streets.
Sure.
The major theaters all closed down, and then subsequently the magic shops kind of followed suit.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was a resurgence where downtown was being revitalized, and a lot of new building and a lot of renovation. We had a mayor who decided to take State Street and turn it into a pedestrian mall, which was more of a disaster, the idea being that limit the vehicular traffic to
right.
nothing but emergency vehicles and buses. And they widened the sidewalks and narrowed the street, and that was a dismal failure. And I'm sure that who knows what contributed to the demise of the shops. But then when they started revitalizing downtown, the rents became prohibitive. And shops like the Palmer House could no longer afford the rent. There was a second shop in the Palmer House that was also owned by Jim Sherman, and it was called the Palmer House Gift Shop.
Hmm.
Vic Torsberg was the manager of the Magic Shop, National Magic, and Chuck Torsberg, his younger brother, was the manager of the gift shop. And after the National Magic closed, much of the furniture, the cases in that, were purchased by Fran and moved up to her new location, which became Magic Incorporated. And the story that I remember, Chuck and both Vic telling me, was that Jim Sherman, who had a lot of money, came into the gift shop one day, and Chuck Torsberg was there, and a long-term employee, a woman, and he said to the two of them, give me a dollar. I'm like, yeah,
okay.
Why? So they both threw a dollar down, and he said, sign this paper. And they signed it. Well, it was a
contract.
Contract to buy the gift shop.
Yeah, okay.
Knowing that it was going to be evicted from the hotel.
Mm-hmm.
So for a while, they ran the
and owned it.
Gift shop. They owned the gift shop,
yeah.
And then moved it to another location in the downtown area. And it didn't last too long there. And then finally, I know the inventory was sold off, and Chuck went to work for another specialty shop in the downtown area. But the idea of being offered this entire business for $1 to me
yeah.
is always somewhat amusing. And then Vic Torsberg went to work. He worked for the New Magic, Inc., formerly the Ireland Magic Company. But then Vic also went to work for a company called Hazma, which was an asthma cure, kind of a patent medicine kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And Vic and I became very, very good friends. Vic was extremely knowledgeable about magic. Had performed in old tent shows and just a kind of a character. I remember one time, Vic was a very heavy man, and we had a kind of an exchange program with Ring 41 up in Milwaukee. So Vic and I went along with other magicians to Milwaukee to the a tavern that the ring met in to do a magic show,
mm-hmm.
and I drove, and Vic was my passenger, and at that time I had a little two-seater Triumph sports car, very small two-seater car.
For a man of his girth.
And Vic had to be about 250 pounds.
Yeah.
So we had a great time driving to Milwaukee, and we did our little show and then came back again. We got to be very close.
In more ways than one.
Yes. But Vic was a good guy. He was a dear friend.
Well, so the roundtable again started then in 29 with a group of just what, about a half dozen guys?
Well,
or who supposedly was part of the original group?
Yeah, there were, well, Dorney was one.
Dorney Dornfield.
Werner C. Yeah. Dornfield. Okay. And I don't know who the other originals were. They issued membership cards. Now, there was a gentleman by the name of Chick Shoki.
And by the way, the roundtable was intended to be kind of a sessioning kind
of
a thing where they just talk magic?
That's kind of strange. My recollection was that you were prohibited from doing magic.
Oh.
It was more socializing and just swapping stories.
Okay.
And although I never saw this, but it was rumored that if you did a card trick, you get stuck paying the bill.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Again, I can't verify that. Yeah. But now, Chick Shoki was an insurance salesman, and he became the unofficial mayor of the roundtable. Mm-hmm. And a friend of mine who was a member sent me a membership card to the roundtable that was signed by Chick Shoki. And the idea of the roundtable, of course, goes back to King Arthur and the Knights of the Roundtable. I'm sure in the original restaurant in 1929, it may have been a roundtable, but as the crowd grew, and you never knew who was going to show up, and obviously, it became more practical instead of a regular restaurant table. And if it hadn't been for Salvador Sala, a local artist and magic enthusiast, who created the most wonderful, wonderful drawing of many of the members who were
over the years,
mm-hmm. And that poster is available online, and I have a copy of it. And there is a copy at the Chicago Magic Lounge, and it identifies just a cross-section of magic, of magicians in this country who, at one time or another, may have stopped at the round table once, if not more than once.
So they weren't necessarily all, even though they were kind of members, they weren't locals. They weren't all from Chicago.
Oh, no. Because, again, Chicago, not only being the center of the country, became the center of entertainment. There were many of these magicians that appeared in local nightclubs during that era when nightclubs were the...
Like Cardini.
Yeah. Cardini mm-hmm. appeared at the Empire Room of the Palmer House. Oh my God. So many performers.
Well, Johnny Platt also was working at the Palmer House, isn't that right?
Johnny Platt worked at the LaSalle Hotel, the Gay 90s tap of the LaSalle Hotel.
Okay.
Which is where Johnny Paul also worked. Now, Johnny Paul was he was a bartender who played the musical glasses.
And
eventually, they would set glasses on the bar
with so much water,
amounts of water,
liquor. Mm-hmm.
To get the notes of the musical scale.
Mm-hmm.
And then I don't know how Johnny got into magic, but then he eventually had his own magic bar in Cicero, which was a west side suburb of Chicago. And then he went through a divorce. Rose was his wife. And then she opened up her own magic lounge in Cicero. And
called? What was that?
It was called Rose's Magic
Lounge. Okay.
Rose's Lounge. It made out of the magic in the title. But I can remember going there and witnessing Clark Crandall behind the bar doing bar magic. But getting back to the other Johnny Paul's Lounge, which was on Cicero. Rose's went on 22nd Street down a couple of blocks. But I remember seeing Johnny Paul. And I remember I was just a kid, and we had a neighbor whose company Picnic hired Johnny Paul to come out to do strolling magic. And that was my first time seeing a magician. I was probably 9 or 10 years old, but having seen him right there, and I was just utterly amazed. He did dice stacking. And
cups and balls.
Yeah, cups and balls, and the real staples of bar magic. But... see what else? Oh, we were talking about the nightclubs. The Sherman House Hotel had the College Inn of the Sherman House. They would have had magicians. All the major hotels. The Boulevard Room had an ice show with and I remember seeing Channing Pollock and Ricky Dunn performing magic. Neither of which I don't remember. They were on skates, but they would have rolled a rug out on the ice while they did their thing. And Ron Urban also had Ron Urban worked on ice. Now, he was just recently awarded the Melbourne Christopher Award in New York. And Ron has kind of, I don't see him around much. I know where he lives, and Have never had the occasion to contact him, although he did show up at one of our local magic banquets a couple years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember seeing Ron when he was about 17 years old, just starting out. And then he eventually started working with Colored Doves, and then in time stopped performing and started producing his own ice show. And I remember being up in Canada one time, turned the TV on, and what do I see but the Ron Urban ice show on local TV in Windsor or wherever we were.
We were talking earlier about Jack Codell, and there was another Dove worker.
Was another he was not born in Chicago, but he lived in Chicago and kind of grew up. I knew the high school he went to because he told me one time the name of the school. Well, I happen to know the principal I worked for also went to the same school at the same time and knew Jack Kudelka. But Jack Codell was another pioneer with doves and parakeets.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing, I never saw Jack perform live, but I remember he had a comic prop that looked like a giant cat with a big grin and an open mouth. And typical of some dove workers who put the doves in a cage, Jack Codell would kind of flip the dove and it would go into the cat's mouth.
That's funny.
Well, one way to get rid of him.
Yeah.
I'm sure in this era, the PETA would be after him.
Well, when I mentioned the Palmer House, if it wasn't Johnny Platt, who am I thinking of who had worked at the Palmer House?
Well, Del Rey was a regular at the Palmer House, and Joyce and I used to do a Palmer House tour for the Architecture Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And it was especially interesting to me because of the entertainment aspect. We would go into the Palmer House and then the Empire Room, which was their nightclub. And it was a relatively, not a huge ballroom type thing, but there was an orchestra. And there was a pianist who was a relatively unknown individual at the time, a young guy from Milwaukee who later on adopted the name of Liberace. And he used to be the cocktail hour pianist. And then they would introduce I think it was the Ben Arden Orchestra. And they would have a floor show with perhaps a comic or a magician and then a singer. And some of the entertainers over the years that appeared at the Palmer House were just, who's who of entertainment. Tony Bennett, Frank Sinatra, Hildegard, the incomparable Hildegard, Eartha Kitt, Maurice Chevalier, Ray Bolger, Sophie Tucker.
Mm-hmm.
The list would go on and on.
And many of those pictures I know are hanging back there in the back room. They were showing us on the tour
once. The Palmer House was renovated maybe 15 years or so ago. A company from New York came in and just pumped a ton of money into the renovation and redid all the guest rooms. And throughout the guest room corridors are the 8x10 glossies of all the performers who appeared in the Empire Room over the years.
Wow.
And just to walk up and down those corridors brings back so many memories. And then there was a secret little panel in the Empire Room that I discovered one time, a mirrored wall. And there was one mirror that opened up, and it was the doorway leading into a corridor through which the entertainers would have come down from their hotel, from their room, to make their entrance into the Palmer House.
To be unseen by the rest of the public, yeah.
Yeah, it was just incredible. It was like walking into a sealed-off area, because in there were all these huge pictures, perhaps 2-3 feet, two by 3 feet or so, of some of the old entertainers. And I would bring the tourists back there, and depending upon their age, we would have a little trivia contest to see how many of them they could identify. Younger people didn't have a clue who the Kim sisters were, for instance. They were a Korean musical group, or who Ray Bolger and Maurice Chevalier were.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it was just one of those little things. I got caught by Ken Price, who the historian, public relations man of the hotel, one time. He said, "You didn't go back there." I said, "Go back where?"
Yeah, not me.
Busted, but anyway, that was a little adventure.
Well, some of the other people, as they continue to go on, tell some stories about some of the people who were members of the Round Table over the years.
Well, if it hadn't been for this famous picture by Salvador Sala.
He also made a beautiful picture of Di Vernon.
He was one. Now, again, I have stories about many of these people who are in the picture. Some of the stories are hearsay, folklore,
rumors,
things that I remember.
Innuendos,
And then some of the stories led to some of the subsequent things that affected me or personally.
Interesting.
That I think kind of, in a way, epitomizes the impact of magic. It's just not somebody doing a bunch of tricks. There were people who I met at the round table or as a result of being at the round table who had a direct impact on me. And again, I never considered myself to be a big, you know, top-level magician. I was just, I continued teaching school all my life, and yet was always in a position to veer off and...
Well, you had your summers off also.
That was another thing. When Joyce and I got married and we were talking about that, we said, we vowed that I would never work during the summer. We would travel. And I had, and again, through magic, I had an opportunity through one of the local magician hobbyists who had a work for a company that did construction estimating. And I had a background in architectural drawing. And I got all excited when I went out to meet with this fellow one day. And I came home and I said, well, I've got a job for the whole summer. And Joy said, but we said.
Yeah.
And I had to call this guy back. Well, he eventually wound up owning the company. And you know, who knows what could have happened. Never looked back.
But you did travel because that one story you told me about how you met Mark Wilson.
Oh, well, that is a direct result of being at the round table at the right time. Now, I wrote this up for the Linking Ring. And when I do this presentation, well, this will be done. Hopefully this little broadcast will come after my my inaugural presentation at the Magic Lounge. But one night after a ring meeting at the Hamilton Hotel, which was in the Loop, a bunch of us went over to the round table and just, you know, the usual coffee and pie or sandwiches, whatever. And Jay Marshall and Mark Wilson walked in. Now, this was back, let's see, in the 60s.
While he was still doing his Magic Land of Alakazam.
I'm not sure whether he still had that show or the Magic Circus, but nevertheless, his impact on magic was just you know, immeasurable. And I just, when he walked in, I was in awe. Oh, my God, this is the guy I watched on TV. And,
right.
I never would, in my wildest imagination, be close enough to talk to him.
Yeah.
Well, I overheard he and Jay Marshall talking, and Mark said, Jay, did you find a puppeteer for me for this trade show next week? And knowing Jay, he kind of shrugged and kind of mumbled something. I said, oh, excuse me, Mr. Wilson. I overheard you say you were looking for a puppeteer. And he said, yes, are you a puppeteer? And I said, well, I am now. Well, we continued the conversation, and he handed me his card. He said, call me. I have this show at McCormick Place that starts next Monday. Mm-hmm. And this was probably, maybe a Friday night. And he said, but can you be down at McCormick Place Sunday for rehearsals? Oh, my God, certainly. Well, Mark had a company called Magical Productions Incorporated that had as its clients many major manufacturing companies and you name it. And he had these wonderful trade show exhibits that were created and built by Johnny Gong, who was just a young guy at the time.
And he was from Illinois.
No, Johnny wasn't was from, he was a Texan.
Yeah, that's right.
He started working for Mark, packing magic sets back in Dallas. Douglas
Magic Land. Yep, in Dallas.
So anyway, I showed up on Sunday at the McCormick Place, and this exhibit was a man from Mars. It was a flying saucer that appeared to be flying, and it was in a trade show booth. And the hatch of the flying saucer would open up, and a man from Mars would pop out. It was basically a stick puppet with one real arm that, silver glove that matched the puppet.
The puppet hands, right.
And it was for a company called General Printing, Inc. And I remember this like it was yesterday because their slogan was, remember the guy from GPI. And, there was a rail around with a little headset so that the trade show attendees would listen to this pitch and then the salesman would bring them in and tell them more about this printing ink that they needed for their company and so forth.
Right.
Well, this trade show exhibit was made for a person about 5'4". Now, I was about 6'1" at the time, and I was determined that I was going to get into this thing. I had to crawl in through the back, and it would have helped if I was double-jointed, but I was going to get in there come hell or high water, and
yeah.
I did.
Yeah.
Pulled it off for the week, and Mark was very satisfied. And at the end of the week, when we were packing up, he said, what are you doing for the rest of the summer? And I said, well, nothing really. I'm a teacher and I have the summer off until Labor Day. He said, well, how would you like to help out on our traveling show? I said, oh, really? What's that? So he described what they were going to be doing. and traveling from state fair to state fair with this big illusion show. So I said, well, I'll have to, you know, call my wife and see what she has to say about this. So I called Joyce and, you know, the usual pleasantries. And I said, oh, you know, she said, well, how'd the show go? I said, went real good. And I have a question to ask. And she said, well, what's that? I said, we have a 50th anniversary coming up in July and early in July. And I said, I know the silver anniversary is 25 years and the 50th anniversary is gold, but what's the fifth? And she thought a minute and she said, fifth anniversary? Oh, that's wood. Like wood is in a tree? She said, yeah, it's the wooden anniversary. I said, oh, really? Well, wouldn't you like to travel for the rest of the summer with Mark Wilson and Nanny? Play on words. And yeah. Say, oh, yeah, fine. So we did. I think the following week, Bev Bergeron, Rebo the Clown, drove in from California pulling a U-Haul trailer and with some of the illusions. And bingo, we packed up and we traveled. Well, for the entire summer, we got home between dates to do the laundry, but it was the most interesting summer because we were just part of a larger show with a singer that some of you may have heard of, a fellow by the name of Andy Williams.
Okay.
And part of the group that traveled with him were the Osmond brothers.
Mm-hmm.
The youngest Osmond at the time was Donny Osmond, who went on to great fame.
Mm-hmm.
Marie, she was not on the scene at all yet. But there were numerous comedians and...
Did you assist or did you perform?
I assisted.
Okay.
I was the push on the prop guy. And Joyce was backstage. She was good at folding silks and taking care of costumes. And and Bev and I were the onstage assistants. I became Bobby Fenton's stand-in. Now, Bobby Fenton was a legend in magic circles, especially on the West Coast. He had worked for Mark for a number of years. So, and part of my costume was a cummerbund, which fit Bobby Fenton. He must have had about a 24-inch waist, and I was still, 6 feet tall, 165 pounds or so. So I had to, had to have that let out a few times. But anyway, being in that atmosphere with some of those performers, I never was smart enough to take pictures to document all of this. Some people may think, oh, this is a lot of BS. But I know that these were people we would go out after the show and, you know, to have an evening meal with some of the performers.
Wow.
And one of the amusing stories occurred, and I wrote this up in my article, which I will be handing out at the Magic Lounge. One of the opening illusions of Mark was the crystal box.
Right.
And a low table would be pushed out by either Bev or myself, and then there was a young lady with us by the name of Margie Rosenblatt, who was a dancer, and she would carry out a glass or a plexiglass panel, and we would and then from alternate sides we'd create this plexiglass box, which was covered with a large cloth and then hoisted up on an A-frame device, and then Mark would whip the cloth away, and Nanny would be waving to the audience. Except one time, I don't know what happened, we spun the box around one too many times, and when Mark whipped the cloth away, here the orchestra was behind us, and here's Nanny waving to the orchestra.
The wrong way.
And the rear end facing the
curtain,
crowd in the in the stands, and well, we caught hell for that. I said, that was the night after we went out for dinner. We sat at the little kids' table.
Lesson learned there.
Not allowed with the big people.
Now, was Harry Blackstone Jr. An occasional guest on the round table?
He was. He's pictured in the Sala picture, but both he and Harry Sr., but never would have encountered them. And, you never knew who was going to be at the round table. And because it was in the downtown area, many of the regulars who were there were businessmen that had offices downtown, such as Chick Shoki, who was the mayor. Another good friend was Herbie Boren, who was a commercial artist, and he was always there. And Dorney may have been out of work a lot, so he was always there. And a few others. And then some of the entertainers who would have been performing locally at the Empire Room, Sherman House, et cetera, who would have had their days free, may have ventured over there. But
Ed Marlowe would have been part of
again,
that?
Marlowe, from the best of my recollection, may have popped in occasionally, more so on the weekends, because he had a regular full-time job.
What did he do regularly?
He was, I believe he was a machinist.
Okay. And so that's a whole different area. I mean, there's the round table, and then there are the people who surrounded Marlowe said that they were part of his group.
Yeah, there was a so-called Marlowe table, and that was a different group that came about in the 70s. I'm not so sure that even some of them may have come to the round table.
Who were some of the people that surrounded Ed Marlowe?
Well, David Solomon, Harris. Okay. Just saw them a couple of weeks ago.
It'll come back to you.
Come back to cut that tape.
Yeah.
Millard Lichter, Casey Bault, Art Wygant, Bill Malone.
Mm-hmm.
They were kind of a subset. I guess they had their own little group that met up more so closer to Magic when Magic Inc. moved up north to 5082 North Lincoln.
Now John Rockerbomer was friends with Mark.
Definitely. He was. And it's funny, I never knew John in Chicago. Now, he was from Oak Park, and he may have come into Magic Inc., because I also worked at Magic Inc.
Mm-hmm.
I did some of the original carpentry when they moved into that old building, thanks to Buddy Gwynn.
Yeah.
And after the carpentry, and again, having the summers off, Fran said, well, what are you doing? I said, well, I wound up working behind the counter as a demonstrator, and I was the mentor to the Junior Magic Club for, I don't recall how long. It couldn't have been, maybe 2 years or so, if that. I still have an article in Genie Magazine about junior magic clubs in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And they featured the Chicago group. And, Saturday morning when the junior magic club would meet in the old theater, what was the theater at Magic Inc., there had to be 50, 60 kids that were part of that group. And we would have, somebody would come in and teach them magic, and a lot of real small groups of magic learning, and there were so many people that would volunteer. I don't even remember who would come in to teach magic, but I often wonder whatever happened to some of these kids.
You mentioned Buddy Gwynn, who was Jack Gwynn's son.
Is that right? And Verdon was his real name.
And you were good friends with Jack Gwynn and go back. And, of course, he was part of the round table then also. But, I mean, you got plenty of stories about Jack Gwynn.
Again, I wrote an award-winning article about Jack Gwynn.
That's right.
I won the Howard Baman Trophy in my art. I never expected that to be. Yeah. In fact, I was a Toastmaster at the IBM banquet when this was awarded, and I had no knowledge of who it was going to. So in my introduction of the executive editor of the Linking Ring, Sammy Smith, I merely said, we're about to present this very prestigious award, the Howard Baman Trophy.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, whoever gets this is really going to be surprised. And I turned the mic over to Sammy, and he gave the whole history of the thing, and he said, and the winner is
Don Weiberg.
Oh, my God. But it was about Jack, who was a neighbor of ours in Oak Lawn, and they, once again, a magician who I remember seeing as a kid, because he performed at the Stratford Theater, which was out on the south side of Chicago, at 63rd and Halsted. And this was a commercial area that rivaled downtown, not as large as downtown, but at one time there were major department stores and at least five theaters that I remember: the Stratford Theater, the Inglewood Theater, which were almost faced each other on opposite sides of the street. There was the Empress, which was a burlesque theater with dancing girls and mm-hmm. so forth, and the Ace, and there were one or two other smaller movie theaters off on secondary streets. But I would go down to the Stratford Theater. They had strictly entertainment on weekends, Saturday and Sunday.
Okay.
They would have a show, a movie. And I think the kid admission was probably 20 cents maybe or 25. But I would go down there on a Saturday morning and have a sandwich in my pocket and sit in the theater all day watching Jack Gwynn. And God, I was just in awe.
What do you remember the most about that show?
Oh, the costumes and the
music you said
beautiful
earlier,
girl,
too.
And the mm-hmm. music. I can still remember the, a Persian market and Chinatown by Chinatown. It just fit the music so beautifully. And the show was so well choreographed. And Jack would finish a trick and whatever, if it was a box of some sort, just kind of throw it over his shoulder and there'd be an assistant there to catch it and carry it off stage, and he was all set to do the next trick. And my parents never worried about me. They knew where I was, and it was a couple of miles away from home,
mm-hmm.
but never feared for my safety. And nowadays, you wouldn't
allow
a kid to do it. But so Jack, and then Jack eventually moved to Oak Lawn. And our first home was in Oak Lawn. And Jack, there were three homes that were very modest. They were all built after World War II with the influx of ex-GIs. And they called it Mystery Manor. Jack lived in one home. Jack and Ann lived in one. Buddy and Helen, his son and daughter-in-law, lived in another. And then the Coles lived in another. Frank Cole, and I'm trying to think of his daughter's name, lived in the third house. And the two end houses were on a little bit of an angle, and then the center house where Buddy lived it created a very interesting little ensemble of homes.
Right, because they all look the same.
Yeah, they're all identical. They're little modest frame cottages. And then, I don't know, the Coles moved. They eventually moved to Hawaii, and Buddy and Helen moved down the block into a much larger home that had a little apartment as part of it. So Jack and Ann moved into that. And then later, Jack and Ann moved into an apartment right around the corner from where we lived. So it was convenient for Jack to walk over. We'd sit on the patio, and I'd listen to his stories. It would go, oh, God, they were just...
Right.
Now, here I am, having grown. I'm now 20-some years old, and I just, again, was in awe. And I used to drive Jack to the IBM meetings on Friday night.
Right.
We only had one car at the time, and Jack always smoked a stinky cigar.
That's what Joyce said. Didn't like the smell in the car.
Saturday morning when she would hop in the car to go shopping, oh, don't let this man smoke in the car anymore. It was terrible. Well, I mean, my God, he's an icon. How could I ever say no?
Right.
But and many, many great stories of Jack Quinn that I remember.
So Jack Quinn, again, was part of the group as the Chicago Magic Roundtable then as well. Trying to think some of the other people who were in the picture over here.
Getting back to Jack. Now, Jack,
When
you talk about where some of the performers would have performed, Jack, I never saw Jack perform at the Oriental Theater, but the Oriental Theater was one of these beautiful 1920s movie palaces. And he was probably one of the last big acts to perform at the Oriental. But then Jack was able to transition from the era of the large stage shows into nightclubs. And Jack would have performed at the Palmer House, the Empire Room. I never saw him perform there.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually, as that market kind of dried up, Jack reinvented himself and found some federal entertainment grant money that was available for performers who would go into schools and talk about the early era of show business, the vaudeville. And Jack would do a show, a scaled-down show, almost a suitcase show, and in high schools. And one of the stories that I have in my article about Jack, he was performing in a school over on the southeast side of Chicago, and would still wear this beautiful kind of a three-quarter length robe and the beautiful turban, very glitzy and glamorous.
Yeah.
And he would leave his, he'd change into his wardrobe and leave his clothes off to the side of the stage. And he was in the middle of his performance one time, and he could see his pants slowly creeping away. Somebody stole his pants and his billfold. And he, of course, had to share that with everybody. Made the magician's money disappear.
You had told me also earlier about a story about Senator Crandall.
So again, this is not a direct roundtable story, but I did mention that I saw Crandall at the Johnny Paul's Lounge out in Cicero, and I'd seen him on other shows in the area. And Crandall was kind of had a dry, acerbic wit, and could be a very sarcastic individual. But he was performing close-up at the Abbott Get-Together.
Mm-hmm.
And one of his effects was the National Magic Spirit Bell. The National Magic Spirit Bell was a little silver bell on a little tripod stand, and it would ring according to the directions that the magician would give it. In other words, the spirit in the bell could ring once for yes, two for no, and he would do a little, it could be used for a little mental effect. Well, the modus operandi to make the bell ring was a little wind-up device, probably cannibalized from an alarm clock. And it was a device that you wound up, had a little bell in it, and you tucked this into your trouser, your waistband of your pants, out of sight. And in order to make the bell ding, you just kind of expanded your stomach a little bit, just thrust your tummy out, and you could control the ding, 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 or however you wanted it.
Right.
So Crandall is setting up the spirit bell, kind of putting it in position, and all the while, and I'm gesturing here, which can't
He's
be...
adjusting his pants then.
His pants, and it'll really make it an effort to get the pants just right. Now, the magicians who knew how the bell worked are in the know.
Sure.
And he said, okay, now this is the way the trick works. I'm going to have this lady choose a card. And he kind of flashed the cards a little bit. And the card that you choose will be transmitted spiritually to the bell. And the bell will ring once for every pip on the card. And then it will ring once. There will be a pause. And it will ring once for clubs, two times for hearts, three times for spades, and four times for diamonds.
Right.
Got it? So finally he has the card chosen, and he kind of reiterates what it's going to do. And the woman kind of looks at the card with a puzzled look on her face. He said, now remember, whatever the card is, the bell will ring accordingly. What card did you choose? She looked around. She said, the 14 of spades. And Crandall went, what? She said, the 14 of spades. He said, 14 of spades? He said, you got to be kidding. He said, I got a double hernia just grunting out a seven of hearts. And you got to be there. But and that was the end. And this took about 15 minutes with appropriate remarks as he's doing the
setup. Build up for that.
And to think that he would have to flex his tummy 14 times plus another, three for spades. Too much.
Well, the guy I was trying to think of earlier was Bert Allerton, was the fellow who I think was working the Palmer House. Is that right? No?
Bertie Allerton worked at the Ambassador East Hotel.
Oh, okay. I'm still wrong.
Which was another upscale hotel on the near north side of Chicago and still there today. And at one time, it was the choice of hotels for celebrities visiting Chicago. They would immediately head to the Ambassador East to stay during their engagements in Chicago, usually. But the Ambassador East had a restaurant. And booth one was where the celebrities congregated. And there was a reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times by the name of Irv Kupcinet, who was kind of the show business reporter and was also, I believe, a nephew of Chick Shoki. There's no connection magically, but Bert Allerton was the house magician at the Ambassador East Hotel, entertaining the celebrities. And once again, I never saw Bert perform. He would come to magic meetings just as a member and associate with people. Mm-hmm. But his magic, from what I recall, was very simple and very direct. But he had a certain charm about him. His real name was Albert Gustafson. And he was very extremely popular and very classy individual and remained at the Ambassador East for a number of years. And then eventually the restaurant, I believe, was called. They used to have servers that were dressed with these big turbans, and they would serve meat on a flaming sword, with a great deal of ceremony. But it was a very pricey place. Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things that I learned many, many years ago was that Bert Allerton lived nearby in an apartment building in the 1200 block of North Dearborn, within walking distance of the Ambassador East Hotel. Well, another friend of ours, who just passed away recently, Eugene Berger, lived in the very same apartment building. Not the same apartment, but nevertheless in the very same building that Bert Gustafson had lived in.
Uh-huh.
And Bert had passed away many, many years ago. But it's just another interesting little...
Yeah, because I know Eugene seemed to be influenced by him because he liked that little aspirin tin
Did. Yeah, it was basically a little aspirin tin with a card revelation.
Mm-hmm.
Simple trick, really. And
but kind of made
and yet in his hands, reputation it became,
Yeah. Right.
I don't remember too much of, and Albert, there was a book written either by Bert or for Bert describing some of the effects that he used.
Edgar Bergen is another picture who is in here, obviously was a ventriloquist and was one of the variety allied arts, I guess, of magic. And I assume that you had never seen him work
or anything.
Yeah.
I remember hearing stories about him having one of his dummies carved by a fellow, I think his name was Frank Marshall, who lived out on the southwest side of Chicago. I know nothing about him, but I think it was Harold Martin, the used magic dealer, who told me that because Harold's father-in-law lived near this Frank Marshall. Now, how true that story is can't be documented, because there were other Bergen figures, Charlie McCarthy, Mortimer Snerd,
right,
that were, I'm sure, created by other carvers or other ventriloquist dummy makers. But I remember also seeing pictures of Edgar Bergen attending the Abbott get-together in Colon, Michigan. So he had more than a passing interest in magic.
Well, they had the Vandarama in association with that a long time, too.
So he
could have been part of that.
I think there's videos of him in Colon, Michigan.
You mentioned the Linking Ring a few times, and the magazine, of course, which is the house journal for the International Brotherhood of Magicians. And I know that John Booth was a contributor for a long number of years, and also was one of the members of one of the roundtable members.
Well, he probably, only stories about John Booth. I did have the pleasure of meeting him on a couple of occasions, but not at the roundtable. But John Booth was a Unitarian minister and had been a nightclub performer doing magic also. But I believe he had a connection to a Unitarian church in Evanston and probably, who knows, would have performed locally. But he had so many other interests. He did travelogues and wrote a column for the Linking Ring that went on and on and on and on and on and on for many, many years. I bumped into John Booth at the airport one time. He was waiting for a plane. I don't know if I was going somewhere. He had a bunch of these 16-millimeter film reels.
Reels or canisters.
Yeah, canisters. Yeah. He had three or four of them. And he was on his way to do a travelogue presentation with these movies. But interesting on that, John Booth has a headstone at the Lakeside Cemetery in Colon, Michigan, but his remains are not there. I have no idea where they are, but there's a beautiful headstone for John Booth, if and when he ever arrives.
Another guy was Bob Lewis, Bob and Ginny also.
Bob and Ginny Lewis.
One of your favorites.
Oh, my God. Bob and Ginny Lewis, I get goosebumps thinking about him because he was such a wonderful performer and got to be friendly with him through the conventions that the IBM held because he was a good friend of Howard Baumann.
Who was another member of
Member of the Roundtable, and eventually became the editor of the Linking Ring and the past international president of the IBM, past international president. But Bob and Ginny Lewis performed on many shows at Abbott's.
Mm-hmm.
Never saw them in Chicago, although they may have been on one of the convention shows here that I attended back maybe 54 or 59. But Bob Lewis had just this dry sense of humor. It was kind of a Will Rogers persona. He played the banjo, and Ginny was the put upon wife, the long suffering lady who assisted her husband and would come out and just kind of throw the props at him, and the stuff would clatter around on the floor, and Bob would just continue like nothing ever happened. And he referred to her as Madame Svoboda. And Bob had some wonderful material. A lot of one-liners. And I remember some of them, but a friend of mine who passed away a little over a year ago, Jim Hoy, was one of the redcoats at the Columbus Magi Fest for many, many years and got to be good friends of him, Dr. Hoy. And talking to him one time, and he had smuggled a tape recorder into some of the shows at Abbott's and recorded a lot of Bob Lewis's material.
Yeah.
So he provided the cassette tape to me, and between the two of us, I put together a little booklet of some of Bob Lewis's one-liners, and some of them were only funny in with his tone, but talked about, I got started in show business. I used to work at a strip club down the street, and I did a little comedy, and got paid $100 a week, and all I could see. And then things kind of slowed down, and they cut me to $50 a week and made me close one eye. I came from a show business family. I had this uncle who was a contortionist. He used to be able to twist himself into a knot like a pretzel. Oh, he was terrific. But then started developing back pains, and he went to an avant-garde naturopath, and in order to make him more limber, he injected mercury into his spine. they didn't realize the dangers of mercury at the time, but it worked. It made him extremely limber, and, God, he was back to his old form again until, he had a gig up in Fargo, North Dakota. temperature dropped to 40 below, and he shot down to 28 inches. And he was dragged away by a cat. I mean, I never heard from him since. And then he would go on in that vein. But in fact, a neighbor of ours was moving, and somebody was in to move a piece of furniture, a big TV cabinet. And I said, you know, I'd help you. But and I thought, here's the line that Bob Lewis used. He's, you know, you never want to get strong and healthy, because the minute you do, somebody's going to ask you to help them move. And if you do, you never grab the heavy end and do a lot of grunting. You grab the, you don't grab the heavy end and do a lot of lifting. You grab the light end and do a lot of grunting. Well, this guy, oh, that's funny. That's funny.
Yeah, yeah.
So his spirit lives on in this little pamphlet that I've shared with very, very few people, because it's just, you know, silly stuff.
Another guy who I met and I saw his act one time at Fector's was Tommy Martin.
Yeah. Now, he was another performer. Once again, I only saw him live at the old 8th Street Theater.
I'm thinking the wrong guy. Tommy Martin was the guy who did the Egg on Fan?
Egg on the Fan.
Okay,
yeah.
I was thinking of Tommy, not Wonder. Who was
Tommy Edwards?
Edwards is who I'm thinking of. Well, sorry. Another story.
Yeah. Now, Tommy Martin was another Empire Room performer, you know, that category. But
I think he was from Houston, actually.
Was he really?
I think so.
Yeah, I remember that, you know, the Egg on the Fan. Oh, my God. My dad and I used to go down to the annual IBM SAM show when I was, I was too young to be a member. No, like, I must have been in my teens. And my dad and mom were very supportive of my magic. And we used to go to the 8th Street Theater show, and it was a big deal. Oh, my God. I saw Akito there performing, and Tenkai and Okino, who were part of the round table. Whitey Roberts was another comic juggler, and Tommy Martin. But getting back to Tommy Edwards was an interior designer and was the president of Ring 43 when I joined, and felt that in order to perpetuate the leadership in the club, that the officers should mentor a younger member. And I became mentored by Jim Ryan, who was a bar magician and just a great guy, and became his assistant program chairman for the club, and eventually became an officer of the club, and blah, 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 blah. I worked my way up. But it was because of Tommy Edwards. Now, Tommy Edwards was a great close-up performer, and his trademark was wearing a top hat.
Bowler, wasn't it?
A bowler hat, yeah. Not a top hat, a bowler, thank you for the correction. And did just some, you know, some very simple magic, but very personable, very likable, and unfortunately, he passed away much too young. I could recall how old he was, but I owe him a great debt of gratitude.
And talk about Harry Blackstone Jr. and Sr., who were there, you know, then, of course, and Tony Slidini was another member.
Again, never saw him at the round table. Obviously would have seen him
at conventions.
I did ride in a taxi cab with him one time from the Kansas City Airport, true story,
okay,
up to St. Joe, Missouri, where David Sandy was conducting one of his famous Ring 129 workshops.
Yeah.
And I rode in the same cab with he and Tom Mullica, and there was one other person and myself, and shared, you know, the usual. But once again, another icon, but very quiet, unassuming gentleman during the course of our hour ride up from Kansas City to St. Joe.
Well, Don Allen is another name that's on there, and that's someone who you knew as well.
He's still in my heart. Don Allen McWethy, became an idol of mine. I was so much influenced by it. The first time I saw him was after a convention, or one of the evening shows at the convention. A group of us went up to Julian's restaurant. And again, I was too young. I was probably maybe 18. And had never seen Don Allen before. I mean, I knew of him.
He didn't have a TV show yet at that point.
No, okay. Before his TV show.
Magic Ranch was his.
Magic Ranch, and he also had another magic show, I can't remember, with Mary Hartline, who was a local TV celebrity. She had been on the, what was it called, the Super Circus on the Channel 7. But I was with these older members of the Magic Masters on the South Side, and Don Allen sat at the table, and I can still remember he had the bug-killing light bulb, which was a rubber light bulb that he, you know, pounded on the table. And then if that didn't get him, he squeezed the bulb like an atomizer, and you saw this puff of powder come out. He did the monkey in the basket. He did the the Roy Benson Bowl and Bagel routine, and the Divino Rising Cards. And I just, oh, my God, I say it slack-jawed. And just was so taken in by that. And got to know Don a little bit better, because every year there'd be a Christmas party at one of the members' homes, and I fortunately became part of that group with Don Allen and his wife Jean, and Jack Codell and Mary, George Johnstone and Betty, and Len Carrion and his wife, Joe Pollan and Mary. Oh, there were several other couples, and it was, and the Gwynns would have been there, and I, you know, thought, my God, how did I get to be part of this group?
Right.
But Joyce and I were married at the time, and I saw Don Allen on any number of occasions, and Don, of course, put out the, well, John Rackerbaumer wrote this most wonderful book about Don in a class by himself, and I was doing a show one time. I worked for a friend of mine who had a kind of a production company that did private affairs and business associated demonstrations, and Ken would provide backdrops and all sorts of audio visual equipment, and he had a gig for a wallpaper company introducing a number of their new line of wallpaper, and the models who were on the runway were introduced wearing an outfit that was comparable in color or compatible with the wallpaper.
Okay.
And my job was to appear in a flash portal opening, walk out, pull a scarf off of one of the models, and then produce a dove, walk back. That was it.
All right.
And during the rehearsal, I looked off in the corner of the ballroom in that afternoon. Who's standing there? Late afternoon, I should say. But Don Allen. I said, oh, my God.
Yeah.
Oh. We chatted a little bit, and I said, yeah, I've got this, you know, one-trick pony.
Yeah.
And he came. He said, I'm going to come back. So he did. He was there for his son's graduation for dinner, and he did come back to see the show. And again, you know, one trick. But
he was famous for his nut production.
Well, the nut production. Oh, see, that was an offshoot of his the bowl and bagel.
Yeah.
He later used a larger bowl, and the after doing the sponge balls and all the gags with the sponge balls, one of which was he put the sponge ball on the table. He said, "Do you know what these are? These are Chinese lychees. Nuts to you." Stupid line. But the finish of the trick was after the sponge balls disappeared, he would pick up the bowl, and there would be this huge nut, which weighed, I don't know, 4 or 5 pounds, a big chrome-plated nut off of a railroad locomotive. And Don would always pick up the nut and drop it on the table to show how solid and heavy it was.
Right.
Well, he was working a party up on the North Shore, the upper crust district of Chicago. It was an outdoor party around a pool, and the table upon which he worked was a glass top table, unbeknownst to him, covered with a tablecloth. So, you know, people sitting around the table, their drinks and a flower centerpiece. When Don got to the conclusion of the trick, he produced the nut and dropped the nut on the table.
Crash.
Crash. And the nut proceeded to go right through the table.
To the floor.
And then to the floor.
And just suck that.
Sucking
tablecloth.
Tablecloth like a vortex. It just
drinks all the flying. Glasses and everything.
Oh, my God. And the owner, the gentleman who had hired him for the show, just thought it was so funny. You know, I'd be so mortified. But, hey, do it again, do it again.
Exactly. Well, as I'm kind of going through some other names, there are some older names like High Berg and Russ Walsh, Paul LaPaul, Red Skelton.
Well, Red Skelton, once again, was a magic enthusiast, a member of the Round Table. And, of course, those who are into magic know that a performer of the name of Tom Mullica went on to make a career out of the Red Skelton tribute show. And we did see that on a number of occasions, but never having seen Red Skelton. But I remember Red Skelton from early radio. That radio was like television without a picture. And my brother and I had an older brother, Bob, was 4 years older than I am. And when we were little kids, we would listen to the Red Skelton show, and then we would reenact the show afterward. My dad was a ham radio operator.
Oh.
And always had electronic equipment around, early wire recorders, and that preceded the tape recording. And Bob and I would reenact the Mean Little Kid, and stupid, but my only association with Red other than being a great fan.
And obviously, you didn't know Dr. Harlan Tarbell of the Tarbell.
Well, I did know him.
Did you?
Because he would come to the IBM Ring 43 meetings.
Okay.
And
he died of cancer, I think, didn't he?
I believe he did, yeah. He was, of course, he was a naturopath, I believe, a naturopath. And kind of a wire little man, you know, kind of stooped over when I knew him. Hey, bye, Cracky. And oftentimes he would be there with his son, Gene Tarbell. And Tarbell was from the lived in the western suburbs in Elmhurst, I believe. And he was not. He was just a very quiet, unassuming man. Never did see him. I think I may have seen him do magic. You know, some little close-up trick for a crowd of gathered around him. But
right.
Another beyond that. Why? And of course, his impact on magic is just immeasurable with the Tarbell series.
Of course. And Paul Rossini.
Another name, just name only, but I know that he also would have appeared in the Empire Room of the Palmer House. Fortunately, the IBM has access to Ask Alexander and all the issues of the Linking Ring and other publications. And if you're not an IBM member, that itself is, if you're interested in history, just to go back through the old Linking Rings, and especially a column called Around Chicago with Frances Ireland. And it is through that she kind of kept a written history of the magicians that were in Chicago performing or just coming through on a train or whatever. And, it was just a fantastic column. So some of these, the names of the Round Table people are people that I only knew as a result of reading about them. But there are still better than, I would say, 75% that I've had some contact with on a personal basis.
Yeah, because as I'm looking at this, it has 108 different pictures of individuals over there, and I've just hit some of the few of them. You know, of course, there was Di Vernon, Charlie Miller, and others. I don't see Johnny Thompson's name here.
No, Johnny, again, is a Chicagoan, and I knew Johnny when he lived in Chicago, just starting out. Johnny worked for the city of Chicago, the Streets and Sanitation. And another obscure fact that I learned from Johnny is that he attended the same elementary school as Glenn Falkenstein. Not at the same time, but they did attend the same grammar school.
That's interesting.
And you mentioned Charlie Miller. I didn't know Charlie Miller. I mean, I saw him on occasion at conventions, but Charlie Miller had a reputation for visiting, staying with people.
That's what made me think about Johnny Thompson.
And never, like he did stay with Johnny for a long time, but he stayed at Magic Inc. also.
Oh.
Because Magic, Fran and Jay had an apartment above the Magic Shop in a large facility, but there was the Charlie Miller suite. And although this didn't occur in the Charlie Miller suite, it occurred adjacent to the Charlie Miller suite. This is a story I forgot about until now. I had a friend who was the executive director of the Theater Historical Society of America, Richard Sklenner, and I was a member of that also. And their mission was to provide archival information about all the great movie theaters in America. And I was with Richard one time, and I said, I have this friend, Jay Marshall, who has an encyclopedic mind and would probably remember many of the theaters that you're interested in. Why don't we get together someday and we'll go out for lunch with Jay? And so we did. We met at Magic Inc. And Jay was busy, and he told us to go upstairs into the kind of a warehouse area. The print shop was located in one corner, and in the usual, oh God, bookcases all over, and
right,
many of the bookshelves that I had built when I did the carpentry work up there. But anyway, Richard said, "Well, yeah, what about Houdini?" And Jay said, "Oh yeah, he appeared at the Majestic Theater, which was built in 1906 or so." He said, "Became the Schubert Theater." He said, "Look up there. There's a bunch of playbills, which were the theatrical little publication." He said, "Look in that little stack." So Richard went up, pulled a couple of them out, and sure enough, here's the Majestic Theater playbill of the week or two that Houdini has appeared. Well, Richard was just amazed.
Yeah.
And as we're standing there looking through that, next to this area was just like an old army cot, heaped with scrunched up newspapers. I mean, a mound of newspapers.
Okay.
Picture a cot that's roughly, say, 6 feet long and 2.5 wide.
All right.
This mound of papers was about 2.5 or 3 feet above that.
Mm-hmm.
And as we were talking, all of a sudden, the paper started to move.
And rustle.
Yeah, rustle. And Richard and I both paused. My God, what is this? We thought, a rat or a raccoon or something. and then the paper started rustling even more. And all of a sudden, a hand popped out. Oh, but two of us were mortified. Well, here it was Fran Ireland Marshall's brother, Johnny, who worked for them doing some of the printing. And he was sleeping off a night out of the town. But and with that jaywalk, Johnny, hey, how are you? Johnny scampered off to take care of himself. But.
Well, I hate to cut Don short there, but actually I did, because we still have a lot more to talk about next week in part two. As you can tell, we were just getting started really talking about the Chicago Roundtable, and there are a lot of stories coming up next week about many of the people who were members of the original Roundtable. So you'll need to come back. Stay tuned for that. In the meantime, let me remind you to please go out and to like us on Facebook. It's at the Magic Word Podcast. Also follow us on Twitter. It's called Magic Word Pod, if you can follow us there. Also on Instagram, Scott Wells Magic. And if you have a chance, if you're listening to this on iTunes, it would always be appreciated that if you can't send us some financial support, you can show us a little bit of love by just going to the iTunes podcast store and giving us a 5-star review. That would be great if you can just say a few words about that. That kind of helps us with our podcast and keeping this going then as well. So I'm just going to wrap this up because it's gone on a little bit long here. It's a little bit more than the usual hour I would like to it. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and honor the past. Never forget it, because we're standing on the shoulders of giants. This is Scotty out.